Well, good morning, everyone. Good, you can hear me. Welcome, everyone. Everyone is welcome in this place, regardless of background, gender, race, etc., etc. Everyone's welcome. And I know there's at least one visitor, but to all of the visitors, a special welcome, and I'd love to speak to you after the service. Some people say the best assessment of a new minister is how many people turn up at the first service held by the minister. But I think actually it's how many people come back the next week. But anyway. I want to acknowledge that we meet on the traditional lands of the Kaurna people. We respect their elders past and present. Now we do have a few notices this week. And I think Mary's going to come up with one as well. But let me just run through these, please. The Shady Grove Combined Service next Sunday, 6th of November. It's 11:30 a.m., a different time, 11:30 a.m., led by Chris Hanna with an address entitled Heritage Matters, whatever that means, and musical contributions by Brendan Moyse again. This will be followed by a shared lunch. Please bring a plate, even if it's an empty plate, that would be fine. So there'll be no service here at Norwood next week. Please don't come here next week unless you want a solitary meditation. Speaking of which, moving meditation Monday 2 p.m, I have a note to be confirmed. Uh-huh. It's confirmed, thank you, Jenny. Well, that was quick. I told you it was to be confirmed. That was Monday 2 p.m. There's a new history book available. The people here are very proud, and rightly so, of the history of the Unitarian traditions in South Australia. Peter Whittam has revised and expanded a full-colour booklet on the church's history, memorials and past personalities. A few copies are available now, and more will be printed on request. It is available in electronic format also. So see Mary in the office, that's Monday, Wednesday and Friday mornings, if you'd like to arrange a hard copy. Also a reminder that 2022 annual reports are due by the 1st of November, that's next Tuesday, so please get them to Mary, subcommittee conveners, program coordinators, I'm sure you know who you are. A committee member nomination form is available, there's one on the notice board, I believe. The AGM to be held Sunday the 13th of November at 11:45 a.m. So the service will have to finish by 11:30, I reckon. If you have any items for the agenda, they need to be fairly special, I imagine, but please let Mary know by Tuesday if you have anything. That also means that membership fees are due. It's a sort of small minimum contribution to keep the whole place going. And it is a mark of your commitment to the church, in a way. The financial year ends on the 30th of September, so that's why fees are due now. $35 for full membership and $20 for members with a concession card. If you want to contact the office, that's probably the easiest thing, or otherwise you might know how to pay regardless. I can let you know that the minister now has an email. It's really easy for those of you who use email. minister@unitariansa.org.au. And that last bit is common to all of the office bearers, etc. So minister is the bit to remember there. So please feel free to email me any time. And one notice I'd like to add is that as part of getting to know everybody, which of course takes a long time to see people one by one, I propose to send out a survey via a program called SurveyMonkey. Some of you may know about it, but it's basically a simple survey. Probably if you have email capacity, you probably get these things from big corporations and so on. But this is about myself and the committee wanting to know a few of your ideas about your experience here and maybe what you'd like to see in the future. So that will probably come out early next week, maybe mid next week. Arrange with Mary for maybe hard copies to be available next Sunday for those who aren't comfortable with email, so that everyone's included. And It's, of course, it's voluntary, there's no drama, but we'll give you about a week to get that back, I think. And it'd be most interesting if we can get a few results back for the AGM as well. It'd be a good place to sort of discuss that. Mary, please come on up if you have a notice. Thank you.
I have a sample here of the history booklet. There's two printed copies on the organ bench. If those run out and you still want one, just let me know and I'll print some more off. I'm also taking any corrections and writing them in here, because no matter how many times someone edits something, there's always something that another person will notice, and one person already has this morning, so a missing word. And then just another little side issue, I have ordered a few of these signs. I was getting a couple for myself, and I thought I'll get extras in case other people at the church want them. So they're just out in the foyer, and if you could drop a gold coin off to reimburse me, that'd be cool. But if you don't have it, just take one. Thanks.
Thanks, Mary. And on the subject of contributions, just about everyone knows we have a bowl in the foyer and a tap and pay facility to keep the whole place going. But your most important contribution is being here. Thank you. Since ancient times, humans have appreciated the symbol of the light overcoming the darkness, of truth overcoming error, and for the Hindus, victory of the gods over the demons. And as we discuss Carl Jung today, perhaps we can ponder the truth overcoming our psychological demons. Beautiful. I hope you haven't all gone to sleep with that. Almost. Relaxing at least. And now some reflections on Carl Jung. Last week I referred in passing to a communication challenge. We all want to achieve a state of grace and peace, but how do we talk about that when many people don't embrace concepts of God, faith, and so on? Well, I think it may be helpful to be familiar with the framework of understanding human behaviour developed by Carl Jung. He was a practicing psychiatrist. He took basic ideas from Freud, but elaborated them and extended them in many directions. And this morning, I can only give an overview of Jung's work. He wrote so prolifically and came up with so many original thoughts about the human psyche. At the heart of it all, Jung was determined to investigate how people with mental health problems might best be healed. He saw the goal of treatment, or indeed healthy self-development, as self-realization, wholeness, or individuation, a term coined by Jung just over 100 years ago. This goal honors the unique personality and internal drives of a person, at the same time acknowledging that one has to interact with the world. The key to a satisfying life is being in harmony with one's internal individual desires while being able to adapt reasonably to the limitations of the external world. Individuation is the process of resolving all those inhibitions and residual emotional reactions from the disappointments and traumas of life. It means a person can make the most of their talents and their opportunities because nothing internally is holding them back. In the absence of an unpleasant event, the person who experiences this wholeness is generally going to be a kinder, more generous person because they are at peace within themselves. They can respond reasonably and appropriately to a problem because their past neither causes undue fear nor a need to dominate or control others. So this process of individuation entails the ability to make the most of one's talents, and also to creatively express one's sense of oneself. The outcome therefore varies with each individual. One person may be fulfilled by an office job, another may be fulfilled by making a good home, another may be fulfilled by sailing around the world single-handedly, or some of the examples we heard from May's classmates in the story. The implication that fulfilling oneself is a process distinct from adherence to the expectation of roles and behaviour laid down by the society around us, it means that individuation may end up with us being in accord with society's expectations, but it also might mean breaking with convention and the expectations of the family and colleagues around us. The journey towards self-fulfillment also carries with it a sense of purpose, going beyond fantasy dreams, a deep sense of purpose which may help us ascertain what roles we might play in life which will make the most of our unique gifts. There is a saying, the meaning of life is finding one's gifts, the purpose of life is to give them away. This aspect of self-development was movingly described in the book by Viktor Frankl, Man's Search for Meaning. Frankl had survived the horrors of the Auschwitz concentration camp, and he went on to become a psychotherapist. His observation in the concentration camps were that those inmates who had a sense of underlying purpose actually had a greater tendency to survive. And incidentally, the German title of Viktor Frankl's book is more inspiring, I think, than the one chosen by the English publisher. Trotzdem ja zum Leben sagen, still say yes to life. Or a more elaborate translation might be, say yes to life despite everything. Because stuff happens, doesn't it? And of course, we're not talking about the meaning of life as popularised in the lightweight work Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which is a bit of a joke about these things. It's a matter of finding each person's own individual meaning of life, where you fit into this interconnected network of humanity and all other living beings. Having a sense of purpose doesn't mean you're happy all the time, of course. There are problems, people let you down. People make mistakes, people pass on. As unpleasant as these experiences may be, they are easier to bear if you have a framework in which everything makes sense, or at least upon reflection. It's important to note that Jung didn't see self-realization or individuation as a cure. That was a common perception by medical doctors in the 19th century, that a disease of the mind was just like a broken leg or catching measles. And it was just a matter of curing the disease so the person could carry on. Jung saw individuation as a lifelong process, perhaps never really reaching the end point of maximising one's potential. He obviously didn't have the same marketing sense as some of today's self-development gurus who facilitate various forms of ego enhancement, offering an end point where you can materialise all your wishes. If only it was that easy. And as an aside, I note that we commonly refer to mental health problems. And of course, there are problems arising from damaged or incomplete reasoning processes, which could truly be described as mental. But for many of the everyday cases of anxiety or feeling flat, it may be more accurate to describe them as emotional health problems. I sometimes wonder why we don't do that more. Anyway, Jung distinguished between our conscious experience and our unconscious. When there is a degree of guilt, fear, hurt, anger, or lust that we can't consciously and rationally deal with in the moment, it may be left to this unconscious part of the mind to do that processing. And Jung described such blocked feelings as repressed. If emotional reactions such as guilt, fear, and hurt are stored in the unconscious, they retain an influence on our responses to daily circumstances. These experiences chain us to the past. The persona we construct to face the outside world is limited by these unconscious factors, meaning that we lead less than a fully authentic life. Consider the situation where you've done the wrong thing by someone, perhaps spoken to them harshly, perhaps wrongly taking something from someone. It's right and it's healthy to feel remorse about such a thing. And ideally, such a feeling would prompt a conscious repentance and perhaps a reconciliation with the other person, if possible, or at least a reconciliation within ourselves. It's a different matter, though, if a feeling of remorse becomes cemented into a sense of guilt and is carried as a burden without release. Although we're not the person we were when we offended people some time ago, we may carry an unconscious message that is often supported by a chorus of people around us: I'm a bad person, or I'm unlovable because I'm selfish, and that sort of thing. Another example is fear. I mean, it's normal and natural to experience fear in many physical and emotional situations. And of course, the natural responses are fight or flight, or taking some action to reduce the threat. I've certainly been in plenty of situations in my political life where I've been confronted by extremely aggressive people. So that's an example I could think of where it's often best to make a hasty exit, but at times it's not possible, and a yelling match ensues. Ideally, one would calmly diffuse the situation by lowering the emotional temperature and bringing the other person into a joint effort to resolve the misunderstanding. But sometimes you're dealing with entrenched egos which are power-seeking, and there's little chance for compromise. Once again, our psyche may not be able to cope with the fear of the moment, and if it stays unresolved, it may warp our image of ourselves. We may unconsciously retain a belief that we can't deal with certain types of people or certain types of situations. And if this is carried forward to influence one's persona, it's going to greatly limit our happiness in relationships or when we come across those same situations in an everyday situation. The same self-limiting process may occur after we've been hurt by someone. For example, if my parents never told me they loved me when I was a child, my ego might internalise that so that I take on unlovability as a part of my identity. And that's going to be extremely limiting in intimate relationships. If I go on believing that this other attractive person can never love me because by my own definition, internally, I'm unlovable. And often we discover we have these negative labels or influences, these complexes, as Jung called them, hidden away in our unconscious only after we repeat the same mistake over and over in our relationships. You may have heard a man say, "I keep getting attracted to bossy women," or a woman saying, "I keep getting attracted to indecisive men." And perhaps you've been in the situation where, with some objectivity, you might have given some gentle advice that if this same thing keeps happening to you, perhaps the problem might be with you rather than with all these other people. So these bottled up emotions, which Jung called complexes, will find an outlet in dreams. Some of our dreams are just processing the events and the worries of the day, but Jung noticed that the deeper psychological problems of his patients were often represented in coded form in their dreams. I was trying to think of an example, and I can tell you that I sometimes have dreams of my daughters when they were in their early teenage years, which were days of innocence, when we had such a great connection. And I suspect it's because I have a lingering regret that I didn't spend more time with them when they needed me around. I should have put them in my calendar more often. Dreams will sometimes appear to be premonitions, because the unconscious motivations agitating the dream are also agitating the impulses in daily life, which create encounters raising the buried problem to the surface. Clearly, the unconscious mind tends to work in imagery rather than well-constructed sentences, so the messages need to be interpreted like art. And indeed, art is often where we find messages from the unconscious aspect of the artist, coming up with a personal truth which may resonate with others. Another outlet for these bottled up emotions is what Jung called shadow moves. Some people have compulsive gestures, of which they're unaware, which reflect an emotional response unresolved inside them. For example, I know a shy, nervous young man, perhaps with some fear of attack if he shows too much of himself, and he frequently, in conversation, scratches one or other of his eyebrows. And the effect of it is to have his hand covering his face in conversation. So it seems to be compulsive, and it seems to be symbolically a way of hiding from an encounter which might hark back to some internalized fear. Another consequence of having these unconscious factors at play in our lives is the phenomenon Jung called synchronicity. He described it as follows. It consists of two factors. An unconscious image comes into consciousness either directly, that is literally, or indirectly, symbolized or suggested in the form of a dream, idea, or premonition. And an objective situation coincides with this content. I was thinking an example was recently a friend of mine wasn't getting the promotion at work he seemed to genuinely deserve. While he was applying for jobs elsewhere without success, he started thinking about boards and committees which he had joined outside of work, not because they were his passion, but because friends had asked him and he wanted to please them. So there's something internal going on that he hadn't resolved. But once he started thinking about it in those terms and deciding to let go of those committees, the very next day he received news he was shortlisted for a very attractive senior position at work. So, amazingly, an objective event correlated with the uncovering of an unconscious motivation. And Jung saw these examples over and over. He also made the extraordinary observation that there were a surprising number of themes and images which a significant number of his unrelated patients described as the imagery of their individual unconscious, as it was explored in therapy. Jung explained it this way. First, there were fantasies, including dreams, of a personal character, which go back unquestionably to personal experiences, things forgotten or repressed, and can thus be completely explained by individual anamnesis. In other words, a thing forgotten, which becomes apparent. Second, Jung says, fantasies, including dreams, of an impersonal character, which cannot be reduced to experiences in the individual's past, and thus cannot be explained as something individually acquired. These fantasy images undoubtedly have their closest analogues in mythological types. These cases are so numerous that we are obliged to assume the existence of a collective psychic substratum. I have called this the collective unconscious. If one accepts this, one can see mythology both as an expression of common unconscious themes, but also an opportunity, because understanding the essence of myths can illuminate the deeper shared concerns of humanity. Jung also observed that there were particular psychic challenges manifested prolifically across many of his patients, which he described as archetypes. He nominated 12: ruler, artist, sage, innocent, explorer, rebel, hero, wizard, jester, everyman, lover, caregiver. So these are symbols around which certain ideas and challenges are collected. Because communication from the unconscious is generally by way of symbols and ideas, he drew them as models in this fashion. But they represented real psychic problems to be resolved as individuals overcome the challenges associated with each archetype. It's a huge topic in itself. Jung had a sense of the spiritual, although he never set out to create a theology. He was clearer, though, in expressing the potential value of religion in providing meaning and purpose. In Roman times, noumen referred to divine beings, and he derived from this the term noumenous, to describe the many and diverse manifestations of spiritual experiences described by his patients. Although Jung was constantly striving to approach his subject matter from a scientific point of view, he was receptive to what would commonly be called spiritual experience. He recounted advice he had received from his own spirit guides. When he was asked once in an interview on the BBC, "Do you believe in God?" he answered, "I don't believe, I know." And I relate this because I gave exactly the same answer to a fellow passenger on an interstate plane trip many years ago. The passenger next to me had been reading some Christian book, and I made a general conversational comment about it. And he said, "Do you believe in God?" I said, "It's not that I believe, I know." And he was sort of stunned into silence for about 5 minutes, and then we had a very interesting conversation. Well, to wrap up this very brief sketch of some of Jung's ideas, I come back to the goal of his therapy: for the individual to resolve all repressed feelings so one can be as free as possible to use one's talents and to cope with the external world. Wholeness, self-realization, individuation. Now, all of that's been a bit intellectual, and many of these ideas can best be expressed poetically. So I finish with an extract from a much-loved children's book, The Velveteen Rabbit by Marjorie Williams, published in 1923. From the murmurs, I can see that it's recognised, but it's so beautiful. I'll read it to you. "What is real?" asked the rabbit one day when they were lying side by side near the nursery fender before Nana came to tidy the room. "Does it mean having things that buzz inside you and a stick-out handle?" "Real isn't how you are made," said the skin horse. "It's a thing that happens to you. When a child loves you for a long, long time, not just to play with, but really loves you, then you become real." "Does it hurt?" asked the rabbit. "Sometimes," said the skin horse, for he was always truthful. "When you are real, you don't mind being hurt." "Does it happen all at once, like being wound up?" he asked, "or bit by bit?" "It doesn't happen all at once," said the skin horse. "You become. It takes a long time. That's why it doesn't happen often to people who break easily or have sharp edges or have to be carefully kept. Generally, by the time you are real, most of your hair has been loved off and your eyes drop out and you get loose in the joints and very shabby. But these things don't matter at all, because once you are real, you can't be ugly, except to people who don't understand." "I suppose you are real," said the rabbit, and then he wished he had not said it, for he thought the skin horse might be sensitive. But the skin horse only smiled. "The boy's uncle made me real," he said. "That was a great many years ago. But once you are real, you can't become unreal again. It lasts for always." Now let's sing hymn 251. So if you have your green books there.
Thank you.
us go out of here, back into the world, conscious of those problems we've experienced in the past, freeing ourselves of that baggage, so that we can be like the hot air balloon before it gets ready to take off from the ground, throwing away the sandbags so that we can soar.